Welcome to another episode of Season Sports with me, Asmir Begovic, where today I'm very excited to be joined by one of the best sports psychologists in the game and in sports all around, Dan Abrahams. Dan, welcome to the show.
Asmir, it is an honor and a pleasure to be invited, mate. I'm really excited to talk to you.
Well, it's been well overdue. You and I have obviously known each other for almost 3 years with our relationship in Bournemouth, of course. And you know, I've done this before on my show, where of course we talk about current sporting events and things that are going on, but obviously, even throughout the years, we've always been able to bring on some specialists in their field and people who I think can give up some really good knowledge and also enlighten people in a different way. And I think you're a perfect man for this. So
no pressure,
especially with the world, that we're living in today. So I think you can give us some really good insight and some positive mindsets and. I think just to be a big benefit to people all around. So, but first and foremost, are you well? Are you healthy? How are you? Your family? Everything okay?
Yeah. Look, well, thank you for asking. I'm well. I'm healthy. Hey, other than coming into hay fever season, which I get quite badly, but that's pales into insignificance as compared to what everyone's been going through. And I just, you know, hope you and everybody there in Milan as well, and everybody around the world. It's been a tough time for everybody, but I'm fine. I'm on lockdown here in a small town called Cheltenham in west of England. As you know yourself, as you said, we've done some stuff together at Bournemouth over the years, and my 2-hour commute down to Bournemouth from Cheltenham. So I'm in the middle of England, and it's been tough. It's been tough, mate. But just doing what I've got to do each day, writing, enjoying writing, talking with clients that I work with, and just pushing on, really, which is all we can do, eh, mate?
Absolutely, mate. Absolutely. Before we get into current matters and everything, you know, I want to kind of take you back in time a little bit. So you years ago started off as a professional golfer, I believe, from what the story you told me. And then you made the switch into being, I guess, a sports psychologist. I mean, how did that all happen? Take me back a little bit in time.
Yeah, well, absolutely. I didn't fib to you, mate. I was a professional golfer. I wouldn't exactly say I was the world's greatest professional golfer. And I'm probably a sports psychologist now because of golf. But I saw a few sports psychs myself when I was playing, when I was competing. I mean, it's one of those sports that has actually used sports psychologists for probably well over 40 years now, you know. So it's a sport that it's well acquainted with sports psychology. And then when I finished playing, when it got to a point where I realized, ooh, this is just going to be a little bit too hard for me to match your Tiger Woods's and Phil Mickelson's, I put down the clubs from a playing perspective and put my coaching cap on and became a fully qualified coach. And I probably fell in love even more with the psychological side of sport when I was coaching. You know, it's interesting as a golf coach because you're spending 40 hours a week coaching. You know, you're there at the range and you're spending a half an hour with the housewife, an hour with the businessman, and then the junior golfer, and then the senior golfer, and then the pro golfer. And you just see so many different people and then a bunch of, I don't know, 50, 66 year olds that you're trying to control, and it's chaos. And so you have all these great experiences. And I think through that experience, I fell in love more with the psychological side of sport. And as I was coaching, I went back and did my qualifications, my degree, my master's degree. I was supervised as a sports psychologist, which you have to do. And I became a registered sports psychologist about 15 years ago. And really, I mean, in terms of when it comes to football, just briefly, it was interesting as a sports psychologist as a golfer, because I listened to sports psychologists speak, and they were always or quite often say something that I thought as a golfer, that just doesn't add up. You know, it's not delivered in my language. And so I was quite passionate about finding another sport other than golf that I really wanted to learn about. From a psychological, from not just from a psychological perspective, but really learn about the language of the sport and the specific challenges that players face. And so it's football. I started to get involved in non-league football 15 years ago. And it just built from there, really, mate. And so now I work across all sports, but I specialise in golf and football. I've worked in football for 15 years, and I've been blessed with the opportunity to work with in great teams and with great players like yourself, and it's great fun.
Did it start for you working more with individuals, as you say, than teams at first, and then sort of working your way through the ranks, as you would call it?
That's a great question. I think really both. I think I was doing both from the get go. You know what? I started working 15 years ago at non-league level in football. Again, just to reiterate, to learn the language and the specific challenges that players face. And I joined a team who, in essence, were in the sixth division in England, alongside a manager called Wayne Burnett, who's now the under-23s coach at Spurs, and has been worked now under Pochettino and Mourinho. So what a wonderful, he's done so well for himself. But I learned so much from him and his assistant coaches, and I learned a lot about leadership and teamship and relationship in football. I learned a lot about motivation from a team perspective and mental skills and psychologically informed environments. So, but at the same time, that's when I got introduced to Carlton Cole at West Ham, who I can talk about because he allowed me to talk about him in my first book, Soccer Tough. And then he introduced me to Anton Ferdinand, who introduced me to a couple of other West Ham players. So it sort of, at that time, it built from a team perspective, but it also built from an individual perspective. And, over the years, I've had contracts at West Ham, Fulham, QPR, Derby, obviously still doing some stuff at Bournemouth. But at the same time, you have the opportunity to work with individuals as well in football and in other sports. So you kind of do both. So, the experiences grew together, I would say.
I think it's fascinating, that line of work. But how does it differ? How does it differ working with teams to individuals? I guess because also when you talk about football or rugby or whatever, all these other sports, it's still individuals within a team. How does that differ working with individuals in a team?
Another really great question. And sometimes, as the whether how you work often depends on what the manager wants or what the head coach wants. And sometimes you'll find that a head coach just wants you to work with individuals and not with the team as a whole. Other times they're a little bit more open to that. So the first thing I'd say is you are, I suppose, this is the wrong term for it, but you're somewhat at the mercy of what the manager or head coach wants. That's
sure, because he's in charge, right?
Yeah, he's in charge. Yeah. I always like to think that I'm now in a position in my career whereby I can say, gaffer, mister, as they say in Italy, I know. Have you thought about doing this? Have you thought about doing it this way? I know you don't want me to work with the team, but these might be the advantages if we go down that path, and try to present the different options. I think that that's important to do, to be a great follower of the leader who's leading you. I think if you get the opportunity at a club, if you're blessed with the opportunity to work with both team and individuals, I think you can do some group sessions with the team. I wouldn't necessarily be one to do something every single week. I think that you want to sit down with the leadership group. You want to talk to that leadership group. And I think you want to find out from the leadership group what they want, what they feel the best way for you to operate with them as a group is. I think that they are your gatekeepers to the team in many respects. And I think if they said to you, look, Dan, we don't want you to do group sessions at all, again, it's a conversation. But I think that's the first thing you've got to do. What do you, the leaders, the six senior players, if you like, what do you think is the best way to go about this? So I think there's that. I think there is room for group sessions. And I think in those group sessions, I would rather do facilitations rather than presentations. So getting as many players talking as possible, which, as you know, can be quite challenging when you've got a group of 25 players who probably don't want to talk and be open and honest. So I think you can do that. But I also think you can do mini group stuff, you know, smaller groups that give players more of an opportunity to open up and talk. And then I really think it's about putting yourself about the place and trying to spark up conversations in the corridors, in the medical department, and working with players individually that way, trying to both formally and informally. You know, those informal corridor conversations are really important. You know, hey, how you doing? How's family? Hey, I thought you played really well the other day. I thought you were mentally really on it. Great intensity, great attention, et cetera, et cetera. I think that's important. I think that if you can have formal individual sessions, that can be useful as well. Not every player wants to do that, and that's fine. But I think the last thing to add here, Asmir, is that a truly integrated process in any elite football team, it includes a psychologist, a sports psych, working with the coaching staff as well. I think that that's always really, really useful, you know, challenging them in terms of how they go about the psychological side, how they lead, you know, how they're trying to develop teamship in their work, what their relationship with players are like, what motivational climate they're trying to produce, how they're trying to deliver mental skills. Because I think so much of psychology can be done on the pitch, on the training pitch. I think so much can be done in your keep balls, your small-sided games, even your passing activities, your shape work, your pattern work. You know, when I've been out there and I'm standing on the sidelines and I'm watching it, I'm thinking, there's so many pockets of moments, chances for leadership, chances for players to experience leadership, chances for players to experience teamship, chances for players to experience a really stretched activity where they've got to mentally deal with it. So I think that starts by working closely with the coaching staff. So group work, mini group work, individual work, both formal and informal, and then work with coaches is how I'd go about it.
Sports psychologist Dan Abrahams joining me in the Season of Sports. Make sure you follow him on Twitter at DanAbrahams77 and you won't be disappointed. But Dan, just to kind of touch on that a little bit, you know, going our relationship, you know, we've never had any formal one-on-one sessions, or not that I knew that I was a part of anyway. But I love their casual chats, you know, because I sometimes thought they had more impact. You know, I'd be in the treatment room or something and I'd be icing my ankle, and for those 20 minutes, you know, you'd be around and we just chat something, and I thought after, okay, something stuck with me, right? So I almost think because there wasn't any pressure on those chats, there wasn't any expectation on those conversations, and sometimes you just walk away and thinking, okay, I learned something there, I learned something that I can take away, whether it was on leadership, whether it was on my approach, whether it's what I could do to help the team. And I thought, you know, those things were always very, very beneficial. And I thought from my observation with you and where you gained a lot of my respect was, I thought first and foremost that, you know, it's difficult when you go into a team environment, and I think you go in a high level team environment, and maybe it's the same somewhere like non-league, as you say, but you were an athlete before. And I always think when I work with people who can relate with athletes, I think it makes it really easier. And that's just my opinion, because you can't go with, you relate, like you've been in my shoes, you know, like, you know, with pressure, you would doubt, you know, it's not all textbook with yourself. And of course you're educated and everything else, but you've been in those shoes before when you were on that playing field, whichever way it is, but you kind of know what, if I'm giving you a thought and you were like, okay, I've been there before. I think your relatability to players is actually, like, I think a big, big thing. And I think that always helps. And I think secondly, what you said earlier is the fact is you sort of molded yourself into an environment and into a culture that, of course, you want to improve and move forward, but you didn't come in rah-rah, I'm going to do this, we're going to do that and everything. You know, you really slid in there. Sometimes without even being noticed, you had an impact. And I thought that was really, really cool. And how does that sort of go with your experience of the past?
I think it's really interesting, and I really appreciate your feedback. I think it's fascinating because it's in my position, you often don't get that kind of feedback. So you're always wondering, you know, yeah, am I making an impact? Is this working? Is this the right way to do it? And I think it's the toughest thing as you're talking now, and I'm thinking about it, and I what I can say to you, I think the toughest thing for sports psych is that sweet spot that you're talking about of having interactions, being involved, yet not how can I describe it? Involvement, but not being claustrophobic. Having conversations, but not crowding players. Having an impact, but I want to say something other than knowing your place, because I think that's not the right way to put it, because I still think as a sports psychologist, you know, you are, it's an important role. But it's just finding that sweet spot, and it's challenging, you know. And it's interesting you saying you found the informal conversations impactful. And I agree with you. If you look at it through the lens that I have, sometimes it's enormously challenging when to have those informal conversations, and you just got to pick up on the little micro details. You know, it might be, you know, it might be you coming in and getting your wrist bandaged, and you just look a little bit, you look like you're moving a bit quicker, and you look like you might be going somewhere. And I know probably is not the time now to start talking to you about your last game of golf that you've had, or the latest, you know, NBA basketball game, which I know you're really, really into. It's just, hey, just let as be. You know, he's in, he's out. And if you're, you know, in the dining room, you're having a conversation with a player, and you look like you're having a deep conversation, I'm not going to go there. I'm not going to come and sit next to you. And it is, sometimes it's difficult to know, when do I go and sit with a player? When do I not? When do I intervene? When do I say something? When do I actually talk about psychology? Or when do I not talk about psychology? So I think there's that side of it. I think the other side of it as well is, as you said, I think it's not appropriate for sports like to come in all guns blazing and rah-rah, and I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that. And at the same time, you still feel you've got something to say. You still feel you've got a framework or frameworks that you can introduce to players that they might get excited about. And you do want to be able to do that. And the reality is sometimes you're going to do that in a room delivering to players, and some players are going to go, yeah, I love this, this is awesome. And other guys just go, or guys or girls, I should say, just go, oh, you know, he's coming in, he's telling us what to do, I'm not interested. I don't think you can win. I don't think you can win that game. You try your best. You try to go about it in the best possible way. It's just getting that sweet spot. I think final thing to say is what you're saying about sport, and I completely agree. And that's a lot of sports psychologists do have sporting backgrounds. I think I haven't played football other than at school, but I played professional golf. I know what it's like to have a 3-foot putt with no money in my pocket, and I'm playing for quite a bit of money. You know, I know what it's like to stand on the driving range for 8 hours a day trying to hone my game. You know, to be quite honest, brutally honest, I know what it's like to come home after a horrendous day missing the cut and be in tears about it. You know, I know what it's like to feel like this is your world, this is your life, and you're going through poor form. And I think it's important to say that we can all imagine ourselves into the shoes or the boots of somebody else. Of course we can. But I do think when you've been a sports competitor and you know those kind of feelings, it's something that other sports competitors like. And I agree. I mean, a lot of the conversations I've had with footballers over the years has been golf, more so than football. And me just trying to go, hey, how does this apply to football in your mind? So, yeah, I think that's I can see why you're saying that.
Definitely. Kind of want to move on to get some modern times. You know, we've been hit with this pandemic now over the last couple of months, best part of a couple of months. It's been challenging for everybody. I think one of the biggest things is, you know, the humongous wave of negativity is what has always driven me crazy in life, and I think in sports and just my career, but people who are negative. Would you say the key for people and athletes and everyone to get through this, you know, positivity is a big thing. And I guess the second follow-up question is, how are you keeping engaged with your teams that you work with, your clients that you work with? at this moment.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting one, and I don't disagree with you. I think every individual is different, and I think that there's definitely going to be, and I know this from the conversations I've had over the last couple of months, is I think first and foremost that I think people have to give themselves permission to be authentic. If we're talking about football and sport here in particular, everybody's going to be at different stages of their career and in different circumstances. And lockdown has been very, very impactful in a negative way for a lot of people in terms of their career, in terms of their potential opportunities. And I do think one has to, you know, you have to give people space to be themselves and to be authentic in terms of, you know, if you're feeling pretty low about it, then give yourself that space. Give yourself that space. Have that time. That's okay. That's okay.
That's a great way of putting it, actually. It's a great way of putting it.
I think it's not about being negative. It's not about being negative. It's about being authentic, you know. Right? And there's not going to be people who can punch the air and sort of say everything's great when it's not. And I just sometimes feel that, you know, if you give yourself some space to be authentic, to be a bit flat and a bit down for a bit, and I'm not saying for 2 months nonstop, you know, then we can start talking about well-being and welfare problems. Then we can start even talking about mental health problems, you know. But if we're talking about the normal population here and you just feel a bit like, oh, wow, I can't believe that happened, I'm feeling a bit down at the moment, that's okay. That's okay. I think at some stage, you've got to create a narrative in your mind, a story, if you like, because that's how we work as human beings. We have a narrative. We have a story. You know, and often the most successful people are the ones who can drive their own narrative and their own story, especially through tough times, through challenging times. I think at some stage, you've got to have a narrative that helps you become mentally alert to the opportunities that you do have. I'll repeat that again because I think that's important. Just a narrative that helps you become mentally alert to the opportunities that you do have. You know, and then we start thinking, well, what can I do? You know, as a goalkeeper, I can do fitness. I can do some handling work here. It might not be ideal. You know, probably there's going to be nobody delivering crosses for me, but I can do something. You know, I can spend a pocket of 2 minutes, 3 minutes here and there reflecting on my best games, reflecting on my dream games. You know, and even breaking those down into sort of a couple of key words. You know, as a goalkeeper, when I'm at my best, I'm alert and alive, or I'm dominant and commanding. Okay, what does dominant and commanding look like? What does it feel like? What do others see when I'm dominant and commanding? Now, what we know in science is none of that replaces physical practice, that mental rehearsal, but it's something. You're being alert to the opportunities that you do have. I can do some mental rehearsal. And I always talk to players about 1% time. 1% of your day is approximately 15 minutes. I think accurately it's like 16 minutes and 20 seconds, but let's go with 15 minutes, right?
Yeah. Okay. That's nice and even, yeah.
So, you know, just spend 1% of your day just immersing yourself in your best games, in your dream games, in those key words that resemble or represent you at your best. Yeah, have some fun with those pictures. You don't have to do anything funky. You don't have to put your thumb and forefinger together and go home, okay? You don't have to cross your legs. You don't have to levitate. You can just do it while you're brushing your teeth. You can do it while you're preparing some food. Your pictures, it doesn't have to be picture perfect. It can be a bit fuzzy, but you're just creating a nice blueprint on your brain and your nervous system. It's being alert to the opportunity. And then, as we said, what else can I do? Well, I can do those handling activities or drills. You know, I can do that footwork on my own. And I think what I would like to say there, what we know from skill acquisition, the research literature there, is that if you are doing isolated practice, if you are on your own, you're doing footwork on your own, or you're doing handling on your own, or, you know, you're doing keepy-uppies, all the things that players will do, even just imagining that you're with somebody else. Even if you're just bouncing a ball up against the wall and you're controlling the ball, even if you're just imagining that ball is coming back, it's a pass from a player. Just imagine there's a player to your left or to your right. Obviously, I'm talking about outfield players here, but if there's a player to your left or your right, you know, and you're checking, you know, you're checking that. That's useful. That is more representative of what you'd experience in a game. So using your imagination when you've got the ball at your feet or ball in your hands, using your imagination can be useful there. And then I just think outside of those more practical ideas, from a well-being perspective, as I think it's about watching your words. Again, as a psychologist, what we know is that well-being is affected by extreme words. Words like disaster, nightmare, catastrophe, words that are very emotionally driven. If you can just make sure that you're using sentences, phrases, words that are a little bit more rational, a little bit calmer, you know, in terms of, hey, things aren't great right now. I'm not 100% delighted that I'm locked down, but it is what it is right now. Okay, what can I do? I'm not saying that we're sprinkling magic dust over you, but just using rational words, using words that aren't too emotionally laden, that aren't too extreme, can be very, very helpful right now. That's a useful thing. Hey, look, there's loads of things. I could go on, but I'm sure we want to move on to something else.
No, I think that's awesome insight. I think it's, you know, just amazing insight, and of course advice as well. I think the biggest thing I learned, I guess, a couple months back now, is that sort of reshuffling of your energy. You know, you have your job as an athlete, of course, and as you say, how can you get better 1% at a time? You know, whether it's doing mental training, whether it's going back to the past games, hand-eye coordination, reactions, fitness. There's always something you can work on. I thought, you know, like, also as a person, you can grow. You know, I've been reading a lot of books and studying different stories and, you know, being more at home, being more present. So there's different ways of, I think, you can evolve as well as a person, and just kind of reshuffling that energy that was used up all on the pitch before and 100%, you know, diverging football. Yeah. I think that's helped me kind of get through that lockdown period before we went.
I love that. And just briefly coming back at you there, I think that again in the sports psychology or even psychology world, we would call that identity. And what you're saying is we're almost trading places here. As I mean, that was a great thing to say from a psychological perspective. So you can be a sports psycho after your career.
There you go.
Players over, but it's a very, very, very important and pertinent thing for footballers at all levels, because as I say to players, because we're so passionate about our sport and we're trying to be the best that we can be, it can be all encompassing and completely immersed in this one thing. And I use actually the metaphor of shirts. We put our football shirt on and we tend to never take it off, because we don't think we should, because we're like, no, got to train well, got to do this, everything's got to be perfect. And actually healthier is to take that football shirt off, and as you said, you know, put on your dad's shirt, as you would do because you've got kids, put on your husband's shirt, okay, put on, you know, your brother's shirt, you've got a brother, put on your golf shirt because you're a golfer, put on your reading shirt, etc., etc. So it's just having those different identities. I love what you've said there, using lockdown to actually change your shirts a little bit more. And enjoy being present in the other shirts, if that makes sense.
Yeah, so true. It's a great way of putting it. We've got a couple of questions in from our listeners, but before we get into those, you've got a lot of other things you've done, of course, and going on. You've written 4 books, I believe, one that I know of, Soccer Tough 1 and 2, Golf Tough, Soccer Brain. Plus, you're doing a podcast, the Sport Psych Show. Which is well worth a listen to, everybody. So, guys, make sure you check it out. Where can you get the books? Where just and listen to the podcast?
Yeah, sure. Our listeners? Thanks so much. The classic place for the books, amazon.co.uk and amazon.com. And for those in and around Europe, there's a great website called thebookdepository.co.uk. thebookdepository.co.uk, which has free international delivery, and there's a Spanish version, Turkish version, and a Portuguese version of Soccer Tough. I know that. And then the Sports Psych Show, my podcast, to be honest with you, yeah, just the usual channels. Just pop onto Google, and if you just Google the Sports Psych Show, probably my name as well, but it should come up anyway. And it's iTunes and the usual kind of Android apps, so you'll be able to find it.
Nice. I love it. Definitely recommend, yeah, those. So we've got a couple of questions in from our listeners. One from one of our very loyal listeners, Milan Obsession, who we very much love on the show. AC Milan have had three different owners, four different sporting directors in the past 4 years. There have been nine different managers in the past 6 years. Is it even possible for a team to develop a winning mentality with so much change? How can players protect mentality, their winning mentality, with such a club or such a club mentality?
Oh, wow. Okay. How do I answer that?
That's a loaded question.
I'll take this loaded question. The first thing I'd say is that, obviously, as a sports psychologist, I have to be very, very ethical and careful about commenting on environments, commenting about other players, and commenting on environments that I've not been into and don't know about. I think that's the first thing to say. I think you and I both know that football is always changing. The one constant is that there never is a constant. And so I think the onus are more and more on players is to have the tools and techniques, the capacity to work on their own mindset, irrespective of what's happening at their club, certainly from an individual perspective. Hey, Milan is Milan, right? You know yourself as you do yourself. Everyone's going to have, by and large, a very, very good mentality when it comes to competitiveness. Could it be better for players? Often it can be, but every player will have their way of doing things. I'm sure they'll be working. You and your colleagues will be, and teammates will be working on their mentality every day anyway. And I think that players go into this knowing that things are going to change. I'm not saying, and whether you want to comment on this, I don't know, but I'm not saying every player can deal with every situation thrown at them. And I've certainly been in environments where it's changed a lot, and players have sort of scratched their heads and thought, oh, this is tough here. This is really challenging. Especially when you have, I don't know, three or four different managers in a season, and the game model changes all the time. And so you're suddenly playing different roles, different positions, different responsibilities. That can be very, very challenging. But, you've got to look to yourself to be able to deal with that and have your own plan. And that's what I always say to players is, what is your framework? What's your mental skills framework? Let's sit down and work on this mental skills framework. I want you as a player to be able to go on a pitch, be able to say to me, Dan, I'm playing this Saturday and I'm doing this, this, and this mentally, so that if we do go a goal behind, I know exactly how I'm going to deal with it. If we go a goal up, I know how I'm going to deal with it. If I make a few mistakes, I know how I'm going to handle myself. I know how to get into my best possible mindset through my warm-up going into those first 5 minutes. I want players to be able to articulate that to me. I think that's vital. I think many can. I think many can be better at that. But I think that's first and foremost thing, no matter what's happening at the club. I think that those situations are ideal from a teamship perspective, from a leadership perspective, from an organisational perspective? Of course I don't. Clubs have their reason. I'm sure Milan have their reason, right?
Yeah, of course. No, I think you raised valid points there. I mean, I've only been here myself 4 or 5 months, so what's happened before, it's impossible to comment on. I think there's general points that makes sense. I guess illogical, because if you're a club and everyone's pushing the same direction, you're gonna be a lot more successful. If you're chopping and changing, it's gonna be difficult. And I think from a player's point of view, just control what you can, your daily effort, your daily training habits, what you can, and don't worry about too much. You try not to worry about too much what's going on off the pitch, and let those people make those decisions that will get paid to make those decisions. So that's my take on the situation. Moving on to another question, we have another question from Ian Aristry. Dan, what do you think separates a goalkeeper psychologically from the rest of the field players, so the outfield players, having worked with them before?
Maybe you're in a better position.
Over
the last 15 years, whenever I've gone into a club and I have delivered a presentation as the first sort of port of call, more often than not, it's usually the goalkeepers who are the first people to come and have a conversation. And look, clearly, as it's because you guys are smarter than everybody else. And also, I just think, as you'd say yourself, and I'm sure it's even cliche to say it now, that it's a position, it's the last line of defence, and it's the most, it's a very, very strong argument to suggest that it's the most pressured position as a consequence of that. So I think that clearly there's that dynamic, last line of defence, so any mistakes are going to be magnified. So there's a degree or an overwhelm of pressure from that perspective. I think the way you guys train as well is interesting, because it's, it's still physiologically hard. You can train, I suppose, a little bit more like a golfer in many respects. You could get more reps in if that's something that you feel is important. So I think the way you guys train is interesting. And so that makes it slightly unique as well. And obviously the viewpoint you're getting, you're standing at the back, coming to the game day here, you're standing at the back, you're seeing the pitch in front of you. I think it's a position that demands being vocal and being commanding and demanding of others. I think of all positions on the pitch, that's where there's some real demands on you there. A lot of outfield players can get away not having that quality and staying silent for most of the game, whereas I think a goalkeeper has to be more vocal, more organised, or more organising. And so having that communication ability is important as well. So I think those are the three things that would separate you guys.
Absolutely. No, I think it's great. I mean, listen, I think we're an individual and a team sport, and I think we're so separated at times that we have our own coach. We have just a different way, a different job, and of course, we come together as a team at some points, and for the most important thing, which is the match. So it's a very different position. I mean, we can talk a lot about it, but it's just very, very different, and that's why it can be divided, and we have our own special coach and work in our own environment. So it's two different. Maybe two different jobs, basically. But Dan, listen, I can't thank you enough for your time. It's been truly amazing, this chat. Absolutely love it. And I hope our listeners, I'm sure they will take a lot from this. And can't thank you enough for your time. As I said, guys, make sure you follow Dan on Twitter at DanAbraham77. Follow him there and make sure you get all his books and listen to his podcast. You won't be disappointed, that's for sure. And thank you again, Dan. Really, really appreciate it. Stay safe and look after yourself.
Absolute honor, mate. You too. Take care.
Well, what an amazing episode we had there. Dan Abraham, honestly, been in the game a long time, and he's just incredible at what he does in his job and how he affects players and how he helps them out. And I think just generally being good overall people and bringing the best out of them. So I hope you guys enjoyed that chat. That was really awesome. I couldn't have enjoyed that anymore, to be honest, and couldn't wait to get him on the show. And this was the perfect time with everything that's going on. So I'll get into a huddle shortly with a couple questions that we've had sent in, which has been awesome. But a couple things to touch on. We've had a couple of days ago, we had the match, big golf game for charity in America, Tiger Woods and Peyton Manning against Tom Brady and Phil Mickelson. I honestly thought it was just awesome. Whenever you can get four legends like that together to play, plus you had Justin Thomas, one of the PGA's best golfers, as the reporter, Charles Barkley giving Tom Brady all sorts of abuse and things like that and banter flying around. I thought it was incredible. What a great event, raised $20 million. You know, what's awesome for them to take the time, but obviously TNT and Capital One to sponsor it. Just what a cool event. And hope we can have that a bit more. I thought the first match between Tiger and Phil was great. Now to have these two legends, you know, these events, I love it. You know, when you get Ryder Cup and all these kind of things, when you get legends together, there's the Icons Cup in golf as well, where you have celebrities playing golf and it's a team event. I just think the more we have of this, the better, and people really, really love it and can relate to it. So what a cool event that was. And everything else is going well. We're training here as a team. We're hopefully to restart the Serie A very, very soon. So very excited for that, hopefully, and hoping to hear some positive news in the coming days, of course. But let's get to your questions. Obviously, appreciate them as always. Keep getting to us on social media. We're on Instagram. We're on Twitter. And we are on Facebook at Season of Sports. And you'll find us there. Keep following us. Keep getting those questions in. We've obviously got an amazing question from our very loyal supporter, Milan Obsession. How was the return to team training? Is life starting to develop more normalcy, or is the pandemic still prominent in day-to-day life? Well, listen, I think, first of all, team training this week has been awesome. Get back with the guys in full pelt, making sure we're ready to go as and when we're called upon, has been awesome. You know, we missed that. It's nice it's been to be in the game the last couple of weeks, but, you know, to obviously have full team training is a different level, and it's been awesome. Is life starting to get back to more normal? Absolutely, it is. You know, restaurants here are open, cafes are open, some shops are open, so there's definitely more life and buzz around the city. Everyone's still wearing masks, taking the right precautions, which is the right way to go, but definitely a lot more normal, and of course that makes things nicer as well, and more of a nicer environment for everyone. So, you know, the masks are still a reminder that the pandemic is still alive and around, but day to day, I think the country is growing. I think the country is going back to normal, and it's been awesome to see. So that was a great question once again. Hope you guys enjoy this pod. Be back with us again next week. Make sure you listen to us on Audioboom, iTunes, Spotify, Anchor. Please leave us a review. Honestly, keep getting our ratings up. Let's get out there. Let's get your feedback, positive or negative. Can't wait to hear from you guys and get your questions in for the huddle each and every week as well. So really appreciate it. Thanks for listening, guys, and see you again very, very soon.